I shouldn't say that. But I think most years we get proposals from Red Lake, but we don't usually get something from that lake reservation. So this is something that we don't hear every year. So I think we ought to get going, and we have an interesting group of people here to testify with us today. Most of which I've already had the opportunity to meet. So, Senator Dill, Representative Dill, there's also a Senator Dill. Representative Dill, this is your bill, and so would you like to briefly introduce? I will move House File 2582. You understand there are no votes or anything today. We're just hearing all of these. So we will hear this, and then by the 17th, we will have met, and this committee will make recommendations on all of the different bills that we hear on bonding.
Okay. All right. Thank you, Chair Spara and members. Thank you very much for hearing this bill. I first have to tell you that the Net Lake Reservation, for those of you who haven't visited it, is very remotely located up in northwestern St. Louis County, and actually the Cooch County splits the reservation out in the middle of about nowhere. They live as remotely as I live up on my island up at Crane Lake. It's about the same kind of remoteness. They've done a they've done a remarkable job in Net Lake. I've had the opportunity to work in the ore community as a city administrator for years and to see the progress that has happened since the mid-90s when the last improvements were made out there. And I don't author that many bills because the ones that I author I want to be passionate about and I want to be fully behind. And this is a bill that I took on because of its great significance to the community. With us today, at the very minimum, you're going to hear today from two sixth graders that are presently enrolled out at the Net Lake School, and then the superintendent of the Net Lake School District, Ms. Teresa Strong. Teresa is a product of the Net Lake Reservation and has worked as well as her sister. They are both highly educated, Ms. Mason, her sister, and they are both highly educated and have become superintendent and director of education of a school district in Minnesota. I think it's really something to be very proud of in our community. And with that, I'll turn the presentation over to Superintendent Strong, Teresa Strong.
Superintendent Strong, welcome to the committee. We look forward to hearing from you.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here. Chairman Sakura and members of the committee, thank you for giving me the opportunity to speak briefly with you. My name is Teresa Strong, as Mr. Dill introduced me. I'm the current superintendent of the Net Lake Public School, District 707, on the Boy Scout Band of Chippewa Reservation in northern Minnesota. With me today are two of my outstanding student leaders, Marissa Mason and Darian Morrison, they're going to be helping me with the PowerPoint and be available for questions and just to give a spark of energy to us as we talk about this proposal. I'm going to introduce Darian, and I want him to speak a little bit and introduce himself.
Good afternoon. My name is Darian Morrison. I am a student of Net Lake Elementary. I'm the president of Student Council. Thank you for letting us speak with you today. Miigwech.
Thank you and welcome.
Bonjour, I'm Marissa Mason, and I am glad that you are letting us speak to you for our school expansion.
All right, thank you. Go ahead, Superintendent.
Okay. I also just want to introduce, just as you see in our audience, we have a number of parents and students. Our community is totally behind our program, and we had a number of families make the four-hour trip just to come down and give support to this program. Our school and reservation are located in next to Minnesota's largest wildlife habitat. We live and go to school on the shores of a 7,000-acre net lake, which is in a remote area that straddles Coochiching and St. Louis counties. We live in the beautiful part of the state that happens to be located at the end of a very long, bumpy road approximately 40 miles south of the Canadian border and 20 miles west of Orr. On behalf of all our students and their families, I want to thank Chairman Sikora for making the long trek north to visit our classroom and our students last month. We are here to request that funding for an expansion to the Net Lake School be included in a 2006 bonding bill. There are three compelling reasons why we need this funding. First, to keep up with the rise in enrollment, to provide the services that are helping our students make great educational gains, and lastly, to make our school safer. First, our enrollment. In 1998, the Net Lake School had 45 students. Today, we have 85. In the next 6 years, we project we'll have as many as 200 students. Our community is blossoming as people begin to find new jobs and find new hope on the reservation. Many band members and others are returning home with their families to live on the reservation. The birth rate in our school district has doubled over the past 3 years. Last year, our reservation constructed 20 new homes and rehabbed 15 more. We also reduced the unemployment rate by 5%. We still have much work to do to build our economy, but our commitment is strong, and we are straining to keep up with the growing demands of an increasing population to our young families. Our school building was constructed more than a decade ago to meet the needs of a small and stagnant population. Today, it is inadequate. The funding we seek will allow us to add 31,000 square feet and renovate existing spaces. This would include a new addition to house our kindergarten through sixth grade programs, remodeling our current kindergarten through sixth grade space for our highly regarded Head Start program, remodeling the presently overcrowded Head Start space into a community resource center, remodeling our present human service office into a common space for educational development programs, provide a new space for health services, upgrade our mechanical systems to efficiently meet the needs of the increased space and sometimes harsh winter conditions, upgrade our safety and facility security, which is woefully inadequate. Madam Chair and committee members, many of you are used to the big numbers, and the idea of a multi-million dollar project for a population of 200 students may not seem like a wise investment. But Net Lake School is not your typical elementary school. It's the jewel of our community, and within its walls beats the heartblood of our community. It will be more than a good grade school. It would be an educational center for the whole community, open from sunrise until late in the evening, offering programs that benefit unborn babies all the way to our most senior elders. Our expanded school building will be a one-stop shop for all services that healthy, successful children and families need. Besides our school classrooms, our crowded building is currently home to a new Lives program for expecting moms, our Head Start program, early childhood family education, after-school programs, our soon-to-begin Boys and Girls Club, GED classes, interactive TV college courses, regular scheduled cultural classes that teach our Indian heritage, community meetings like the one we had last year, which brought over 150 people to discuss drug awareness. This combination of programs is an essential component to the maximum effort loan. Minnesota Statute 126C-72 mandates that schools using the maximum loan program must make efficient use of the building. They are encouraged to design and integrate social services and library services, which is exactly what our program and our facility does. These programs benefit more than my band members. They are open to anyone who lives in our area. Anyone can enroll in our GED classes, and there have been several community groups meeting in our building. Every spring and fall, we host the students from our local Cook and Orr schools for our cultural camp classes. And then instructors from local colleges also provide guest lectures and often draw a wide range of audience members. All these outside groups and activities enhance their role as a community resource. But we don't allow this to distract us from our core mission of educating children. The impressive strides our students are making academically is confirmation our programs are succeeding. Which brings me to the second point, why this program is necessary. Services and the links to the student achievement. Success does not come easily for young people in our remote community. Though we made strides in building our reservation economy, our unemployment is still 26%, which is 5 times higher than the state average. Per capita income is less than $5,000. 2/3 of our students in our district qualify for free and reduced price meals. And yet our students are succeeding. The state sets a base proficiency score for reading at 1260. We have boosted our reading scores from 1269 in 2002, which is just above the state base, to now 1456 in 2005. We are closing on a goal of surpassing the state average of 1542. Last year, our reading proficiency rate was 89%, far above the 56% target set by the State Department of Education. And I'm proud to say our kids have a 96% attendance rate. We know we are doing a good job, but we know we can do better if kids have the resources. The building we have planned for our community will also have an attached health clinic, allowing us to better educate our students on healthy living, exercise, and proper nutrition. The national studies on this topic are irrefutable. A healthy child is a strong academic achiever. The integration of good health habits and lifelong learning is an essential component in any community. In Indian country, it is critically important. This school year, we screened all of our children for diabetes and discovered an alarming 45% of our students are at risk for this disease. The health of our children leads me to my final point, safety. We are all too familiar with the shock and violence that has occurred in our country's schools, and more recently, even in our state. We must make our school building safer. Right now, our building is configured such that people can walk right in. Access is not controlled. The building expansion project will allow us to control access and add other essential features to safeguard and protect our children and our staff. The cost for expanding an LA school is approximately $11 million. The adjusted net tax capacity for our school district is quite small, only $50,000 for the whole district. There is simply no way we could fund a school construction project without state aid. I believe our project is a perfect example of why the maximum effort school aid legislation was passed. The legislation in Minnesota Statute 126C says the purpose of the program is to utilize the credit of the state to relieve only those districts where the maximum effort by the district is inadequate to provide necessary money. Our local conditions in this isolated area of Minnesota are such that any school construction would far exceed the maximum effort loans. This program helped us construct our school over a decade ago. We are current on our payback to the state and have never been in arrears, meeting our obligation to make payments. We are working hard to raise funds. We are a small tribe, but our tribal government is fully behind us. In the past 5 years, Voice First Band has invested $3.2 million in educational funding. We have applied for grants from the Federal Impact Aid and the state's new tribal foundation. Just as important as our tribal government support is the support of our local community. The local contribution required in statute for this project is approximately $305,000 and will be funded by district general obligation bonds. In November, we held a referendum that passed by an unprecedented vote of 116-4. The people in our community support our school in more ways than simply at the ballot box. We have a very active parent committee that raises money for special projects in our schools and encourages home reading and homework as well as extracurricular activities. We have many elders who show up each and every day to mentor our students and volunteer with reading, cultural classes, lunchroom duty, and in any other way our students and teachers need them. Support for this project extends well beyond our school district. Your former colleague and this committee's former chair, Commissioner Alice Segan, and her staff at the State Department of Education have carefully reviewed our proposal and have given it high remarks. And in fact, the commissioner and the staff told us we were the number one priority for funding in this year's bonding bill. Despite the commissioner's endorsement, we were not included on a list of the governor's recommendations. But I have great faith that if an educational facility is really needed in a community, if the project is well thought out, if there is strong community support, and if the case is made to you in a respectful and thorough manner, it will receive your support. As a graduate of NetLake and an active member of the school learning community, I am absolutely convinced that this project is desperately needed, well planned, and strongly backed by our local community. Your support, members of this committee, will help us create a facility that will not only empower our children and their families to succeed, but literally to excel. An expanded NetLake school will help us provide the services our students need, keep up with rising enrollments, and make our school a safer place to learn. For all these reasons, I urge you to support our request that funding for an expansion to the NetLake school building be included in a 2006 bonding bill. If you have any questions, Marissa, Darian, and I would be glad to answer. And after we finish questions, we do have a short video on the Boys Court reservation if you're interested, Chairman Sikora.
Okay, we'd be happy to show the video. Would you like us to show that before you start questions? May it make a difference in the questions?
It's up to you. The video is a little outdated, but it gives a good history and an overlook of our reservation. Okay.
Why don't we do that right away?
We'd like to show it now.
Yeah, I think the history would be good to have as we go forward. Would you hit the lights?
When I learned how to dance, I was a child, and that's usually when you started. I could dance any style that I wanted to when I was a child, and then when I got to be, I'd say about 12 or 13, then I started as a fancy dancer, and I stayed in that category till I was about like 17 or 18, and then I didn't dance anymore for a while. I went away to school and got kind of left the Apollo Trail for a while. And then when I came back, I started as a jingle jazz dancer, which is what I am now. And if I ever gain any wisdom, I may advance to traditional dancing. They're the ones that they keep the knowledge that we need to survive as a people.
Bonjour. I'm Doris Leischel, chairwoman of the Boys Court down in Chippewa. I'm proud to share with you a collection of some of the stories and memories of our people that will describe our cultural heritage and our plans for the future. Part of the richness of an oral history is that everyone speaks for themselves, and their many different versions form a common truth.
Told me the story of the origin of the NetLake people. And the story went like this. Long ago, the Ojibwe people were wanderers. They had come from far in the east to find a home for themselves. They wanted a nice place to settle down. The Ojibwe people listened to the elders of the tribe, for they were very wise, having spent many winters on this earth. Many of the elders had special gifts or powers to help their people. One band of Ojibwes, there was a wise old man. This man had dreams over and over about a special place where he could go to pick a wonderful medicine that would help his people. He wondered what the dreams meant, for he knew that he was being told something of great importance. In his dream, the old man saw a large lake covered with Manomen. Manomen was a very special gift to the Anishinaabe, a gift from the Great Spirit. The lake was very big and had thousands of ducks and geese on it. There were many animals for the Ojibwe to hunt. Finally, one day he told his people of the dreams he had. The people listened, for they knew that many things were told them in dreams. They left by canoe and traveled down a river, now called the Lost River. The old man became excited as he began to recognize the places he had seen in his dreams. He knew that truly his dreams were leading his people to something important. The whole band wondered where they were going. Soon the river widened, and the old man saw a large and beautiful lake covered with minomino. Ducks and geese were all over. The people could see a small island in the distance, and on the shore they could see children playing and sliding in the water. The old man and his band stopped and walked on the island. There they saw the medicine and began to pick it. As they picked the medicine, the people saw many different symbols on the rocks of the island. Even below the water, they saw the sacred symbols on the rocks. As he gathered medicine, he looked up and saw a spirit which looked like a man standing nearby. The old man walked over to the spirit and stood near him. The spirit talked to the old man and told him many things. The elders of this band to this day do not and will not tell what the spirit told the old man. The spirit wore a shirt that was as fine as spider's web. The Anishinaabe still live today on this lake where the old man led them.
The Boys Fort Indians, who call themselves Anishinaabe, have long lived in the great northern woods. In fact, early French explorers called the Indians after the tall, thick forests, in French, Bois Fort, in a strong tree. The Bois Fort people lived in harmony with the rhythms of nature. Rather than staying in one location, they moved through the woods as the seasons changed, always finding what they needed from the land and the waters.
My personal philosophy is that we were never a people who were set in one place and actually had different camps, such as the Sugarbush camp, such as our fishing camps and our blueberry camps or summer camps.
On my grandfather's side, he said that they lived like on the lake. They stayed right on the lake in the summertime on an island. And whatever the season was, you know, they went over like to do the maple sugar. They would go to that area.
I went and lived with my grandma when I was about 4 years old. And I used to help her when she did things like make birch bark baskets and stuff like that. I would be the one that climbs up in the tree and get with a knife, you know, come down with the knife and then she'd take a stick and she'd go around the tree with it and the bark would fall down.
We used to go picking blueberries. They used to ripen about in July. Pa'd take us out there. Then that was quite a time for us to go blueberry picking, you know. That was a lot of fun.
I still remember my first one right with my grandma. I just lived with a kid. He's not the right. That is fun on me though, no.
My grandpa had a house in that lake and that's where everybody would come, you know, to go racing in that lake and that's where we'd be. We'd campers around my grandpa's house and we'd all have a parching place, parching, and all take turns parching race. Everybody cooking at my grandpa's house. To us, you know, the way we feel about wild rice is very important to us because we'd like to keep the tradition going, you know, our way. Not being a traditional way, like we try.
Although ricing and other Bois Fort traditions were very strong, they did change when Europeans began arriving in the late 16 and early 1700s.
When they first came here, the fur and the timber companies, when our lifestyle started to change, they liked the goods, you might say, that they had to make it faster. like the pots, huh? The big kettles, make it boil, cook faster. The rifles was better than the bow and arrows. And the steel traps, axes, saws, made our life faster, so to speak.
The rich land and natural resources in the region attracted more and more non-Indians. So the U.S. government began taking what it wanted in a series of treaties.
The substance of the Treaty of 1854 was basically to cede all of the land from International Falls to Duluth up to Grand Portage, in which we would move out of the lands, and we would cede that territory to the United States government. And in return to ceding all of that territory, the United States government said that you may hunt and fish and gather, you know, so long as the winds blow.
Under the terms of the Treaty of 1854, the Boys Fort Indians were given the right to select reservation lands in the vicinity of Lake Vermilion, which was the heart of their community. The lake is a vital link with waterways to the west, east, and north, and was a key location for travelers and traders. Although the Boys Fort people traditionally moved with the seasons, the largest group of them tended to live around Lake Vermilion, which was the ancestral homeland to many of them. Unfortunately, Indian rights didn't matter when reports of gold beneath the Boys Fort lands began to circulate. The rush was on to move white prospectors onto the lands and Indians off.
I think the most significant portion of history regarding the gold rush was that the impact that it had on the Boys Fort people. When you have a bunch of people vying for natural resource interests, someone has to bend it. And unfortunately, it was the people of Boys Fort who, through an act of Congress, had to relocate to the Net Lake Reservation.
This was the Treaty of 1866. Under the terms of this treaty, all claims to a reservation near Lake Vermilion were relinquished, and a reservation of about 100,000 acres was established at Net Lake. Even though the Boys Fort people were forced to move, a strong leader named Chief Bustacoggin managed to protect them. He insisted that the Boys Fort Indians have certain rights when they were moved from Vermilion to Net Lake.
He was a great defender, I guess, of our people's rights, or one of the first great defenders of our way of life and of our people's rights. To me, he's one of our most well-respected and one of the forefront leaders of, you know, that shaped the way we are right now.
Even though the Vermilion Reservation was reestablished by an 1881 executive order, the Boys Fort Indians were only given back 1,000 acres instead of the tens of thousands they had been promised in the Treaty of 1854. Beginning in 1889, the federal government continued to take away from the Indians. It offered them small individual allotments on the reservation, then sold the rest of the land to lumber companies and other non-Indians. Indians who did take allotments often lost them later on because they did not realize they had to pay taxes on land where timber was logged. As a result, the Boys Fort people lost nearly two-thirds of their land. Even worse, the government began requiring Indians to prove they were competent and then took children away from so-called incompetent families so they could be assimilated into the white culture at far-off boarding schools.
When I was very young, about 5 years old, I went away to a boarding school. We couldn't speak our native tongue. If we did, we were punished. I had a few real tragic incidents while I was there with my girlfriends that taught me to really look out for other people, which I've been doing most of my life.
Did assimilation work?
No.
I don't believe it did. I guess to some extent, of course, it did. It was an insidious policy, I guess, and it did succeed in destroying a lot that Indian people hold dear.
A lot of them, what they did to the parents, they would just go around, I suppose, if they had room for more students, they'd just go out to the lakes and pick up kids. They wouldn't even tell the parents, and then the parents, or if the grandparents were babysitting. Well, they come and took their kids, they're sending them to school, you know. That's what they did. They didn't have a choice whether or not to keep their kids home.
In the 1920s, progressive people in this country started taking a look at how Indians were being educated and took a real good look at boarding schools. The Marion Report in 1928 blasted the boarding schools. The Indian Reorganization Act in the early 1930s then paved the way for dissolving the whole system.
The Indian Reorganization Act was a recognition that assimilation had failed and that Indian people and Indian governments should be strengthened, not weakened. It was followed by other policies of the 20th century, such as the Freedom of Religion Act, the Indian Child Welfare Act, and the Indian Self-Determination Act, which marked a new respect for Indian sovereignty and self-governance. Indian nations like Boys Fort were offered the choice of managing their own government programs. Also during this century, the Minnesota Chippewa tribe was formed as a political union of six Chippewa bands. This helped the Boys Fort band further strengthen its tribal government. By 1997, the Boys Fort Reservation Tribal Council had assumed full control over the delivery of all government programs and services to its people. Today, as the Boys Fort band enters the 21st century, the Tribal Council employs more than 100 people to provide the programs and services that band members need, including education, housing, health care, law enforcement, protection of natural resources, food assistance, recreation, and job services.
Well, people are using the programs more, which is cool to me, you know. I wouldn't be sitting here if we didn't have these programs here, you know.
The Boys Fort Band is particularly proud of Net Lake School, which opened in 1995, after band officials lobbied hard at the state capitol for the new facility.
We did a lot of knocking on legislators' doors, doing the lobbying bit, in which we spent several days and several weeks, as a matter of fact, testifying before various committees so that we could get the funding for it.
The state agreed and partnered with the band to build the beautiful new school, which was designed and decorated with Indian spirituality in mind. For example, a focal point of the building is a central hall with a glass ceiling. Known as the Path of Life, this hall progresses through rooms dedicated to programs and services for each age group: infants, young children, teenagers, and adults.
Personally, I've seen the school evolve from basically a six-room classroom and with a gym into this big multi-room, multi-faceted educational institution, which to us right here is our landmark. I mean, I'm so proud of that building.
The band is also working hard to build its economy so it can provide good jobs and new opportunities for its people. The Boys Fort Band owns a sawmill, a wild rice marketing program, and Fortune Bay Resort and Casino. The seeds of Fortune Bay's success were planted in the mid-1980s when the band opened its first casino, which offered high-stakes bingo. Then in 1988, the Indian Gaming Regulatory Act was signed into law, recognizing that tribes had the power to regulate gaming on their own land. The Boys Fort Band signed gaming compacts with the state of Minnesota, and in 1995 began construction on Fortune Bay Resort and Casino.
For me, Fortune Bay has not only provided a job, it shows me and a lot of other band members that the need for education is vital in business. So what I've did is combine both my work experience of over 13 years of gaming experience and took the time to have an education also during that. Hopefully the people that do both can come back and work for their people, the Boys Ford Band.
I think we're living in an age now where one can be a professional and still be fluent in the language and take part in traditional ceremonies. I think we should look forward to a future where we can now combine them and no one's going to be self-conscious about it.
To me, being an American Indian today is something that I'm proud of. I think life is a circle, and I think we were once a great nation itself, and I think life is a circle. We're going to come back around.
The continuance of the circle rests in our children's understanding their rich legacy and carrying it proudly into the future.
I hope this video has given you a better understanding of what it means to be an American Indian and a member of the Boys Ford Band. By sharing with our own people and others, we help preserve the powerful culture that makes us who we are today. Miigwech.
Well, that provides you with a little history of our band. Like I said, that was created in 1999. Since then, we have new tribal government representatives. We have more economic opportunities, more housing, housing development and education has taken off. So what you've seen here was just kind of the beginning of the success that we have today. And we're just really proud of our community and the reservation and especially our school.
I'd like to add, Kiers Cora, that one of the things about the school, this is a K through 6 out at Net, when these kids next year, they will come in about 25 miles into the Orr School, into the St. Louis County School District, and then they'll go ahead with their schooling and graduate from St. Louis County School District. And one of the things, my wife's a teacher in the Orr School, and my son is a sophomore in the Orr School. And one of the things that's really a wonderful opportunity is that we get to integrate our ideas and our beliefs and our cultures between the two schools, not only as at the seventh grade level, but much younger than that, actually, because I used to be a famous basketball coach locally. very, very locally. Fifth and sixth grade, and I can tell you that we made many, many trips from the Orr School with both kids that are in our community in Orr and also the native kids that are in the older grades out to Orr School to use the facilities, and there has always been this open-door approach in the entire community. So to think that the Net Lake School is isolated in the sense of its openness to be willing to support and help our community is not the right idea, because we've really worked, and I have to congratulate the band on their work in improving their economic successes and by reaching out and doing economic development. One of the things I want to bring up, and then I'll close, is that, you know, they own the Net Lake Band owns a casino. It's a beautiful resort on the shores of Lake Vermilion, but I could be corrected, but I don't believe that they've ever made a single per capita payment to any of their band members. They've reinvested all of their money that they've earned in these other businesses, in their economic development work, in their health care, and in their education, and in their economic opportunities that are outside of just the reservation. I think that's an admirable trait. And another reason to really look at this project as the number one priority, as Commissioner Segrin did. This is a real opportunity to help, again, boost some really fine people. So with that, I think we're ready to take any questions you might have. And thank you for your attention to this project.
Ms. Strong, did you want the students to testify before there's questions, or are they here to answer questions?
They're here to answer questions.
Okay. All right, members, questions. Representative Newman, go ahead.
You're having a bad season on that.
I know, I am. I'm having a bad year. You're right. I'm having it. We should have come back in January. I might have been able to adjust better.
Yeah. Thank you, Madam Chair. I have two questions. First, Superintendent Strom, could you give us a little bit more of a history of the loan payback that the band has been involved with and the success that you've had with that? I don't know what the previous loan was for, how much, how long ago, what the payback was. Do you have any information on that at all?
I could Ms. answer Strong. That. Yes, but I think if I could call Miss Jude is our financial specialist for our bonding. She did our bonding in 1994 when we went for the first maximum effort loan. She helped us with that, and now she's on our side again as a second.
Welcome, Ms. Jude.
Madam Chairman, representatives, I'm Carol and Drude with Ehlers and Associates. We're financial advisors to governments, and we're advisors to the Net Lake School in their previous application for capital loan. I think it'd be fair to say that the last loan built the facility that you saw in the video. And they had quite a small school prior to that, and this was, as I understand it, rather, the new building was pretty much built around the original. And so I think that it'd be fair to say that's what the money was used for, and someone else can probably be more specific about the services and what is contained. For those of you that may not be familiar with the capital loan program, once a contract is signed with the state of Minnesota, the recipient of the maximum effort capital loan, in this case the Net Lake School District, has an obligation for a period of not to exceed 50 years to make a debt service levy equal to a percentage of their adjusted net tax capacity. Over the last few years, that number has changed a few times, but it's currently 28% of their adjusted net tax capacity. So the levy that is made and collected is used first to pay off the local debt, and if there is money available beyond that from that levy, the rest of it is sent to the state to pay towards the capital loan payments. The debt of the local debt of the Net Lake School has been retired. So basically, all of the money that is collected as a result of the maximum effort capital loan levy is sent in the fall, in December, to the state of Minnesota to pay toward the loan. So my understanding is that every year that payment has been made to the state on time.
Representative Newman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Follow-up question, and maybe for Mr. Strom, I'm not sure, but can you give me a working definition of what is allowable for purposes of this type of a loan? And the reason I'm asking is I'm looking at this schematic, and you know, for instance, we've got health services or a clinic, we've got Boys and Girls Clubhouse Edition, Head Start. There's some adult education development, as I understand. And my essential question is although we obviously can use this money for purposes of construction or remodeling of classrooms, but is this type of a loan available for the project that these folks have in mind from a legal standpoint? Madam Chair, Representative, the details of the capital loan program are laid out in statute, which is in Minnesota Statutes 126C.63 and forward. And I'd be happy to make copies of the statute for you. If you look at the bill summary, in the second paragraph of the bill summary, you'll see that there are a list of items that are specifically prohibited under the maximum effort capital loan. And this is the bill summary for House File 2582. And those purposes that the legislature has specifically excluded from coverage are things like swimming pools, ice arenas, athletic facilities, daycare centers, bus garages, and essentially that's a list that the legislature has put in of the types of projects that they don't want built with maximum effort capital loans. In terms of what the legislature has asked for, essentially included, in the late 80s, there was a strong effort, in the early 90s as well, a strong effort on the part of the legislature to integrate other kinds of activities into school buildings. This was often referred to as the co-location of services. And those services included social services as well as library services. So those efforts, those items essentially were included in the statute as the superintendent had mentioned earlier, as allowable expenses under the maximum effort capital loan program. So essentially the general charge is for school buildings. There are specific items that are excluded, and then there are some efforts that are essentially urged upon school districts, including the inclusion of the co-location of other services.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Demmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Welcome, Superintendent Strong. Nice to see you again. I was along with Representative Sikora, and we came up, if you remember, came up and saw your school, and I would like to reiterate how nice it is, and the school is it's a beautiful facility, and I might mention very well maintained, and I think I remember seeing some of the kids. I remember the young man. I think I might have seen him in the classroom. I'm not sure, but it was a pleasure to be there, and I just wanted to comment on that. I do have a question, and I think I asked you something about this when we were up there, Superintendent Strong, about your economic growth in your area. You do have a population that's growing. You mentioned some of your statistics, which I hadn't seen before, about the growth in employment. Could you elaborate? And I don't know if, Bill, if you want to weigh in on this too, but where is that growth coming from? What do you see for economic development and maybe the growth in your student population? And in conjunction with that, you might want to touch on some of the kids coming from Orr. But could you talk about your growth, both in terms of students and in terms of economic conditions?
I'm going to answer that question and invite our district representative, our Secretary of Treasury from the Board of Sports, then to come and answer and elaborate what I can't elaborate on. But as a superintendent of the school, looking at our student growth and our community growth, what I contributed is the housing development, economic development, that the tribal council's really taken an aggressive approach and created new jobs, new opportunities, enticing families to come back, that was providing them homes. We see a lot of welfare reform families coming back. I think the school building has a major impact on parents' decisions to come back to the reservation. In the past, they might have looked at the school building and thought, well, you know, I can buy my child's education better if I send them to a different school. But I think the school is really making a positive impact and successful student gains where parents are seeing that and wanting to come back. So again, economic development, housing development. Our school has taken dramatic increases in our academic achievement. You know, those three factors, welfare reform, those are all factors why we see families coming back. And more families are staying in the community, where in the past they would leave for better jobs. And things. We have new young families having children and different economic opportunities, housing and things, where they're choosing to stay. We have people coming back as well.
Well, Representative Score, I'd like to take a crack at that one as well.
Representative Dale, thank you.
This is a very enterprising group of people, and I have to tell you that over the last decade particularly, maybe a little longer than that in my recollection, they have expanded their economic base by using the casino and by buying different businesses that are diversified, businesses most of which existed and needed good management, needed proper capitalization, and they have purchased these businesses. For example, they own a major car wash manufacturing company. They own a radio station. They own a sawmill. They employ many people in those businesses and businesses beyond that that I'm mentioning. And I think that one of the key ingredients when I was a city administrator in Orr, and again very near the Netlake Reservation, is that my key goal as city administrator, and I sense that their key goal at the reservation, is if you can provide a good job and a good education, the people will come. And I think if you look across the Iron Range at how we've approached rebuilding our economy, because our economy has suffered from mechanization, from the federal government taking lands away from all people where logging is done up in the Boundary Waters and the Superior National Forest and those types of things. Now, we've had to be smarter, we've had to do it better, and the people are beginning to come again and wanting to live there. They want to live there for the same reasons that people from the metro want to go up there and vacation and own vacation homes. And so I think all that is a product of success. It's not one fell swoop that they use to make that happen. It's like a cake pouring in the different ingredients. And the school is kind of the sweetener, like sugar is to a cake. Now, the cake is good. The people come. They're locating there. And they're finding work. And they're not finding work where it's minimum wage jobs. They're finding livable wage jobs that the band has had the foresight to create through their economic diversity programs.
Chairman Sikora, we also are able to provide some of that college education that in the past we were not able to provide. We are an hour away from the nearest community college, which is takes a lot of commitment for a student to travel every day an hour there and come back an hour. We are now able to provide college courses in our school with interactive television, online courses, and we're looking to expand those possibilities. And Fortune Bay is now offering college courses at the base. It's called College at the Base. Families and young students can stay on the reservation and get their college education. So like Mr. Dill said, provide them the education, they're likely to stay around. So I'm proud to say that we're able to provide those educational opportunities for our families.
Thank you, Ms. Strong. Representative Dimmer, I'm sorry.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I do have one other question. I guess that this might be for Mr. Strom again. One of the things I was looking at in the qualifications, district will serve at least 80 pupils per grade in order to get a positive review and comment. I do have one more follow-up, but is that something that is more of a guideline as opposed to a requirement, Representative or Mr. Strom?
Madam Chair.
Sorry, I just thought I'd gave you a demotion there, the representative.
Madam Chair, Representative Dimmer, Mr. Crow and I were just talking about, I think that line in the bill summary is an error. There used to be a limit if you weren't eligible for sparsity revenue, which the Netlake District is. Okay. There used to be a pupils per grade limit, but that's no longer in place, I believe, for all districts. But that didn't apply to sparsity districts, and Netlake qualifies for sparsity revenue. So that's an exception that they already met. But I believe that 80, and that's what we were just looking for, I believe that 80 pupils per grade limit was removed in the changes a couple of years ago.
Okay. Madam Chair.
Representative Dennis.
I will assume that is the case unless you tell us differently. I guess just as one last general comment, and again, I couldn't be more impressed with the facility, with what you're trying to do. Using analysis of the cake, I think if we use milk as the thing you put all the ingredients into, I think the school probably is the milk, and it really is the hub. I understand that. I do have to fall in line a little bit with Representative Newman in some concerns about whether this is the right way to do that with a maximum effort school loan because of the nature of what the project is. And that would be my only caveat to that whole thing. And maybe there's some other things that can be found, some programs available, whatever, that are more appropriate than using a school loan for some of the social service things that are being done. But having said that, I'll just throw that out. But having said that, again, it's nice to have you here, and congratulations on and your community and what you're doing.
If I could make a response to that, when we first did the maximum effort loan, and in statute it states that a school building should utilize all different programs and have a cool collaborative effort between programs to make sure students are educated as a whole. And we did it in 1994 when we first built the program. We brought a number of different programs into the building, Head Start, daycare, human services, counseling for kids and parents. We brought those in, and it was very successful. from that program to now, we have seen great gains in our family support, our student attendance, our student academic achievement. In the community support, we have seen drastic changes. So what we did in the past with the maximum effort loan and using what the statute says and collaborating different programs, we took that advice and used it, and it was successful. Now we're looking to expand it and only, you know, take what we've learned and our mistakes and expand it more. And I think the health services department is just going to benefit our kids. We talked about the diabetes and the health and alcoholism problems that our parents are going through and things like that. Our health services is just going to only benefit and make a stronger child and family. So that's where I think our health service is important to have it included.
Thank you. Representative Clancy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for providing us the interesting video, too, with the background. I think that's really helpful as we proceed with the analysis of this. My questions are around two sets. The first set is about your sixth grade class of students. Are there plans or intentions to expand beyond sixth grade, first of all? And then do some of your sixth graders go to OR for their education?
All of our sixth graders go to OR. We are building the kindergarten through sixth grade program, and we have no plans to include more grades into our building. We actually worked with other neighboring districts and talked to them and did an agreement that we will not build onto our schools or the 8th or 7th, 8th, 12th, you know, T-12 grade building. All of our 6th grade students go into the OR High School, which is 20 miles away.
Okay. My second set of questions then, thank you. First one is, do any of the OR students or other non-Boise students, boys, attend the Net Lake School?
Do
you have that reverse?
Ms. Strong.
We do have open enrollment students coming into the district. It's not a high number, the open enrollment students are not our projection for student growth. We're not seeking or enticing students to come into our school, and that's not part of our expected growth. But to answer your question, we do have some open enrollment students come from OR, as far away as from Virginia, which is an hour away. So we do have families seeing the school and seeing the student growth and wanting their students to become a part of our school district.
One more.
Representative Flensing, one last question.
Thank you. And you started to talk about this, but what are your enrollment projections into the out years?
I'm sorry, I couldn't hear.
What are your enrollment projections?
Our enrollment projections, as I stated in my speech, in 5 years, we could be up to, we're looking at 200 students. And we use that birth rate, we look at our birth rate, families moving in. Our birth rates are doubling. It has been doubling within the last 2 years. It's doubled, and we see that doubling in the future.
All right, Representative Grinning.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Dill and Superintendent Strong and members of the band. I'm very impressed with your progress, and I just have to offer an apology. I had hoped also to visit your school. Representative Sikora had invited me, but when the time came, she said it was a rushed trip and they didn't have a chance to notify me. So I missed out, and I was very disappointed about that. I did get up to Red Lake separately, but I didn't get a chance to get to Net Lake, and I would have liked to. I have a question for the students. And I noticed that Head Start is a part of the project, and I wondered if either one of you or both of you went to Head Start, and if so, how you think that affected how well you're doing in school.
Which of you wants to take that on? Darian, Marissa, which of you? Probably hard to remember.
Good.
He's a man of few words.
Madam Chair, so he went to Head Start?
Did you go to Head Start, Darian?
Yeah, I did.
Okay. Did you like Head Start?
It was fun.
You learn anything?
I learned my ABCs.
All right.
Great.
How about you, Marissa?
Yes, I did go to the Head Start, and I think I put... it helped me too, because then I'll know like the people and how the program works and stuff.
If I could, can I elaborate on that? Sure. Look at our Head Start in the past. Look at our Head Start now. Our Head Start in the past was in a separate building. Our Head Start in the past did not have a core curriculum, a curriculum that teachers can look at and say, this is what teachers need to learn, or students need to learn. The teachers need to be taught. It did not have a national or state standards or district standards that we expect our students to learn. Today we have our Head Start in our same building, where our ECFB programs, our kindergarten programs, our elementary programs can collaborate and do activities together, and the Head Start kids can transition easily. We now have district policies and standards where we expect our teachers to uphold. And our students, when they leave Head Start, we expect them to know. So Head Start is no longer a play place, a social environment. It's now more of an academic learning. And we also have some of the successes that we have seen in our elementary program is a rigid, high expectation for students, teachers, and parents. We have a really rigid reading curriculum, which a portion of that reading curriculum is taught in our 3-year-old and 4-year-old. So the reading program that we teach in our elementary program is taught in our 3- and 4-year-old classroom. So that again shows the transition and the expectations and the community support behind our Head Start program. We are very proud of our Head Start program and believe very very strongly that education is number one in those young years. So that's, expanding our Head Start program and providing the space. Right now we're turning away families because we cannot service our Head Start children. By law, we can only accommodate so many students per square feet. We're turning away our families from Head Start. And once we have the adequate space, we'll be able to service all our kids and provide that education that we strongly believe is critical in those younger years. So I'm a very supportive parent. I have a student. I have a child in Head Start, so I have a heart in the Head Start program and really strongly believe as an educator that's where it's at. So that kind of makes the comparisons of Head Start of old to Head Start of new.
Madam Chair. Representative Grady.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to comment to the members of the committee, Representative Heidgerken and Dabney, if you could listen. next week on March 8th, and I know with the full support of Chair Sikora as well, we're visiting a school that's 8 minutes from the Capitol that I think sounds like it's much like yours. It's the John A. Johnson Elementary School, and they also have the full package there where they educate, they have the health care needs and the early childhood, they have the Y, they have Hmong community, and like you, their attendance and health academic scores have increased because of it. And I think I'm just so impressed with your school and the enthusiasm of the superintendent Strong as well.
Thank you, Representative Grinning. I would like to call your attention to the little paper we passed out on the third grade reading and math, fifth grade reading and math. When we were up there, I was very impressed with the school board members and the parents and their commitment to their students learning to read, because personally I believe that parents are kind of where it's at. The parents are so behind these programs that it was pretty impressive to see that. And I didn't know what to expect, but I was very favorably impressed with it. And I think if you look and see the difference between the number of students who, early on were testing in the lowest possible category, and then, as the years move on, look at where they are. There's nobody left, for instance, in fifth grade reading in the lowest category in 05. I think that this is, you know, this is not a quirk in numbers. This is real progress. And so I just wanted to make sure that you noticed that because I thought it was quite impressive. We have one more question. Representative Heidgerken.
Thank you, Madam
and
Chair.
And moving on to libraries.
Yes, it's more of a comment than a question. something that was surprised that the superintendent and Representative Dill did not bring up. Your school and what you have accomplished over there in drug awareness and gang awareness is a model for the rest of the tribes. You've had very, very good results in those areas that have been problems prevalent on a lot of the with the tribes. But I read an article where you guys have done an excellent job in that area. I want to commend you for that.
All right. I think that is the end of Nat Lake. You got quite a lot of time in this committee today. Thank you very much. I know what a long drive that is. I've done that. And then we even had kind of snowy, icy roads on top of it, so that was interesting. And you're right, Representative Breiling, it was a quick trip. We went on Sunday. It was the only time I could find. So we left on Sunday and came back on Monday night at about 11 o'clock.
Madam Chair, if I'd been notified, I would have been there, though.
I don't know if you could have. It seems to me we had looked at some of those dates for, well, maybe you could have.
Yeah, I could have.
But in any case, I did call Randy Demmer because he is, Representative Demmer is also on bonding. So I called him to see very short notice if he could go with me. Thank heaven. So anyway, it was an interesting trip. And, you know, I would recommend to you to take a little trip up to Lake Vermilion and that area. It's really, it was quite pretty in winter in the snow. And I'm sure it's incredible in summer. All right. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And this will be, you know, we will discuss all of these proposals eventually and come up with our recommendations.
Okay.
Thank you. Have a safe trip back. Representative Erickson.
Oh, you didn't! I know! I always wear my library button. Hi, how are you?
Representative Erickson, are you ready?
Thank you, Madam Chair and Committee. I'd like to move House File 2885 for possible inclusion in our capital request from K-12 Education. This is the Library Accessibility and Improvement Grant, and I just wanted to tell a short story, first of all, about my experience directly with this program in the fact that last year we did have a bonding request finalized at $1 million, and then, of course, what the commissioner does is she sells the bonds, and then she takes a look at all the requests. And I had a library, Malacca, and I think you remember them from 2 years in a row. They gave wonderful testimony here to show that they deserved to get a piece of the pie, and they were awarded by Commissioner Segrin and her committee a generous grant of about $350,000, and they had on their own, of course, raised well over $1 million. So that's just really a great tribute, I think, to a small town, and my documentation that this program does work. This year our request is for $10 million. The needs are great. That's for both accessibility and improvement grants. As I think you could tell from my remarks just moments ago, these end up being matching grants, so it isn't that we give away free money. There is a responsibility on the local end. And the grants are made available to libraries that need handicap accessibility first. And in this go-around for 2005-2006, there were two requests, and that's probably why Malacca got to come out as a winner. But the need is there because we have older buildings, and so they need to be accessible to our handicapped folks. I think you realize that libraries are a regional need,
We have 360 public libraries in Minnesota. I have two regions that I represent. One is Great River, which has a wonderful access through the St. Cloud area, which includes my Benton County folks and some of my Morrison County folks, although I have a regional area there too. And then we have East Central, and I have folks here today from East Central Library. As a teacher at Princeton High School, I used to spend more time at the East Central Library in Cambridge than I did in Princeton, because at the time we didn't have our wonderful new public library, and our school library did not always have the materials that I wanted to access for my students when we were working on research projects. So I took great advantage of East Central. So can really stand firmly on the fact that the public library system does work in Minnesota. Dollars that we're requesting today are badly needed for renovation, expansion, outright replacement. Local communities, as you know, Malacca was a good example. We worked long and hard for 4 or 5 years to raise those dollars. But it's difficult in a small community when the demands on a small community are greater than just for a regional library. Public libraries, as I just said, serve a wide variety of folks, a regional area, and I think that's what we need to think about today. So with me are Elaine Keefe from the Minnesota Library Association and Jane Robbins, who's the mayor of Pine City, which is right next door to me. So welcome, ladies.
Welcome, ladies. Ms. Keefe? O'Keefe, did you wish to speak next?
Yeah. Madam Chair and members of the committee, thank you very much. For the record, my name is Elaine Keefe, and I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota Library Association. And as your summary notes, since 1994, each major bonding bill has included funding for the Public Library Accessibility Grant Program. And then last year, the program was broadened to include both new construction of brand new libraries and also renovation of existing libraries. And I want to thank this committee for your strong support of that change. We think that's a very, very positive thing, and we're very grateful for it. You have in your packet a handout that looks like this that I want to point out to you that lists all of the grants that have been made under this program since its inception in 1994. And because it was just accessibility for so long, the first 8 pages of the handout are all of the accessibility grants that have been made. And it's alphabetical according to the city that the library is located in. And then the last page lists the first 2 construction grants that were made from the money that was provided in last year's bonding bill. And as you can see, Malacca is one of the 2 that were made last year that Representative Erickson was talking about. And this is a list that was provided by the Department of Education. I also want to point out on the front page of this document in the box at the top that there really is a very substantial local contribution, although the required match under this is $1 of local money for every $1 of state money. In actuality, you can see on the last line that for every state dollar that's been put into this program, $6.51 have been spent at the local level. So you're leveraging a lot of local effort. And I want to point out, too, that that's not just tax dollars. You've heard testimony in the past for folks who have talked about raising money for their library buildings through private donations, bake sales, rummage sales, penny drives among school children. I mean, communities really band together to try to put everything they can into their local public libraries. But many of them need state help, and that's where this program comes in. Last year's bonding bill provided $1 million for this program for the library accessibility and improvement grants. That's the level of funding that we have typically gotten in every bonding bill since 1994 that has provided money for accessibility alone. Now that the program is broadened, we really would like to see those dollars go up. As you might imagine, $1 million for a statewide program that includes new construction, renovation, and accessibility just doesn't go very far. And there's plenty of demand. 2 other handouts that you have, the green sheet and the orange sheet, are lists of projects that we've identified around the state that would be likely to apply for these grants in the future. The green sheet is probably the more interesting list. Those are the projects that we think will be ready to apply for the money that is provided in the 2006 bonding bill. So basically over the next 2 or 3 years, they're going to be ready to start construction. And we list the library system that they're part of, the regional library system that they're part of, and the actual library, the estimated total cost of the project, what the state's portion would be, and that is assuming that everybody would get the maximum grant allowed. Obviously, that doesn't really happen, but this gives you some idea of what the demand is. And so if you look at the totals on the bottom, we can anticipate more than $18 million worth of applications to this program in this next bonding cycle, and that's why we're asking for $10 million. I know the chair has told me that this is a bit ambitious, but we think that the need certainly can justify that number.
Ms. Keith, can you tell me how many dollars worth of applications were there for the $1 million that ended up in the bill last year?
I believe it was $2.3 million. Our state librarian is here and can address that if you'd like, but I believe that that's the number.
No, I was just curious.
Yes, for the $1 million. And, that was kind of a short timeline. This was the first year of this. I think, as you can see, there are a lot more projects being planned around the state. And there are a significant number of public library buildings in the state that need badly to be renovated or to be replaced. 54% of our library buildings were built before 1969, and 32% were built before 1939. And these older buildings, many of them are just not equipped to provide modern public library services. They don't have enough space for public access computers, for children's programs, for young adult study and research, or to accommodate new technology. And so there is a tremendous amount of need statewide. I do want to mention, too, that in the past, there were four communities that did receive funding directly in the bonding bill. There were two communities in 1998. Grand Rapids received $1.2 million, and Little Falls received $500,000. And then in 2000, Pelican Rapids received $500,000, and Watonwan County Library, which was located in St. James, received $1,011,000. And obviously, when you compare it to the pool of money we're talking about for a competitive grant program, those amounts are substantial. Because those communities had that success, you might recall that this committee for a while dealt with a whole slew of bills requesting money for individual library projects. And we really felt, as the Library Association, that a better way to handle these requests was to broaden the purposes of this competitive grant program and have everybody go through that. And I think we've done a good job of selling this. We've succeeded in convincing libraries that this is the way to go. And you might notice that you don't have any of those requests before you this year. I haven't seen any of those bills introduced. There were no such requests submitted through the governor's capital process last year. And, we think that that's a good thing. But in order to continue that success, we need to make sure that there is enough money in this pool so that libraries that have good, solid proposals have a reasonable chance of getting a grant. Obviously, it's a competitive grant program. Not everybody is going to get one. But we want them to feel like they have a reasonable chance. If there's not enough money in it, I think you'll start to see those individual requests crop up again, and we hope that that won't happen. I just want to say one more thing in closing, and that is that public libraries are not just a local resource. They typically do serve residents from well beyond their borders of the cities and counties that fund them, and your library card is good at any library in the state. The library card that you get from your local library, you can use anywhere, and I think that that's a real benefit to Minnesota citizens. But it also points out that I think it's appropriate for the state to partner with local communities to help make sure that we have, modern facilities that can provide up-to-date good public library services. So that's all I have to say. I don't know if you want to hear from Suzanne right now or if we should go to Mayor Robbins.
Madam Chair, I just wanted to make sure that the committee met our new state librarian because Suzanne has come on board kind of in between. So I would like her to just say a few words to us.
Please introduce yourself for the record.
My name is Suzanne Miller. I'm the state librarian. I am pleased to be here and hope that we can continue to grow library services for the state of Minnesota that has done such wonderful things so far. But as things change and evolve very, very quickly in our world of libraries, we want to make sure that we stay at the front end of the the curve as opposed to following along behind. So that's my charge, is to try to make sure we collaborate and maximize our efficiencies and do the best we can to provide library services across the entire state.
Ms. Keith, could I just ask you a quick question? It looks like you about $600,000 went out the door, and there should be about $400,000 left then?
I think, Madam Chair, maybe I'll let Suzanne Miller answer that, but my understanding is all the money has been spent.
Okay. I'm looking at page 9. Is that not relevant?
Madam Chair, Suzanne Miller, the charts do indicate that on the last page that those are two grants for construction. This is the first year for construction money, and we separated that from the accessibility. So at the end of the page before, you should have two accessibility grants. Actually, there are three accessibility grants to Albert Lea, Minneapolis, and Thief River Falls for accessibility. So that actually used up the entire $1 million and did fall short of the actual request that was submitted, the total request submitted.
Okay. Thank you for that clarification. And Ms. Robbins, did you wish to testify?
Madam Chair, yes, if I may, please, and I thank you for being able to be here with you today. I am the mayor of Pine City, and Pine City, for those of you who do not know where it's at, we're about 70 miles straight north of here on Interstate 35. I'd like to share with you today the need at our public library in Pine City. It is part of the municipal building, I'm sorry, that was built in 1978, and so it serves as our city hall and also as our public library. The total amount of square footage for both is 81,000 square feet, of which the library has 2,000 square feet. So we're bursting at the seams in reality. Just this past year in 2005, our circulation at the Pine City Library was 65,000, servicing them in a 2,000 square foot area is a real juggling match. The circulation in 2004 was 61,000. So we continue to grow just over that 1 year of 4,000. Our children's program during the summer went way over 300 participants this year. And it's just a wonderful program in our area. We operate as a branch of the East Central Regional Library. And the city provides the building, and we also provide them with an $8,000 budget per year. So we're a small municipal building in a very fast-growing community and a fast-growing county. Our space is very limited, and our shelf space is really down to absolutely zero. We have an opportunity to have more computers in our library because of space problems. It is very, very limited. We also have the privilege in Pine City of having high-speed internet to our library. It's a multiple T1 capacity, which is really great for our community and would be used even more if we had the space for those additional computers in our library. Recognizing the need for an expansion in Pine City, Pine City and the library have cooperated, and we have established a nonprofit entity, and we're working on fundraising to do a new building, very likely to be separate from the municipal building because of space constraints. We do have accessibility problems now in our present building. We're on a one level, but because of the constrictions in the space of the 2,000 square feet, it's very, very difficult for people with handicaps or with wheelchairs and special needs, and a real problem there as well as with the overcrowding. Our basic problem is we're looking to find a building that would be large enough to serve all the residents in our area. But our taxing authority, of course, is just within the city limits of Pine City, so we would have to go out and look for funding in our region and the population that's served. Now, the population of Pine City is 3,143, but we increased that to well over 10,000 by going out into our townships and three other cities. The three other cities would be Pine City, the city of Rock Creek, and the city of Henriette. Then we have five adjoining townships, Shangwatana, Mission Creek, Pine City, Pokegama, and Royalton, and that's Pine City Township as well as Pine City City. And there, the population at our last census was over 10,000 people. So you see, we serve a lot more than in the actual population of the city of Pine City. Now, we realize that there are some funding availabilities out there through a bond issue that would probably provide the largest portion of the expansion. But we can also go to the townships for funding and then also to the foundation, which we have established now in Pine City that is well underway, and we're planning a fundraiser in the very near future. So we've done some preliminary work on obtaining donations and so on to get it going. At the beginning of this, when we realized we really needed to proceed with the expansion project, we did an assessment. We hired a consultant, and he has done an assessment on space needs. And the need out there now is from 11,000 to 12,000 square feet, is what the assessment has proven. It's extremely difficult for a community to raise all those necessary funds, and the grant program would greatly enhance our cities as well as cities across the state to the completion and the renovation of our building and others. Therefore, I would encourage you to support House File number 2885 as sponsored by Representative Sandra Erickson, thank you very much. An appropriation of this level would certainly provide an incentive to our Pine City Library project and would allow communities across the state as well, in rural communities and the metro area, for their needed improvements or their needed expansion. I do have some handouts with the basics of Pine City, and I probably do not have enough with me because I was not sure how many would be here. But I will provide those to you, Elaine, and for distribution to the members of the committee. And I would be happy to answer any questions that anyone might have. Madam Chair and members, thank you very much for your attention. And the citizens of Pine City would greatly appreciate your highest consideration for the request. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mayor Robbins. Are there any further questions for the people at the desk on this proposal? Hearing none, we will lay this one over for possible consideration in our bonding recommendations. Remember, we only get to make recommendations. So thank you very much for your time. And members, if you notice in your packet was the blue slip. So if you were here on Monday and Tuesday and you were requesting per diem, you may fill out your blue slips. And then also, I would like you to peruse the minutes, please, of yesterday's meeting. Since that was just yesterday, we can probably all remember. It was that April one that was tough. Representative Newman?
I did yesterday.
You did. You won't do it, Representative. Representative Greiling?
Madam Chair, I move to approve the minutes.
Thank you. Are there any corrections, additions?
Madam Chair, I actually haven't read them, but I have faith in our staff that I haven't found any mistakes yet.
Representative Greiling, your faith is well placed because our staff is very good. So hearing no additions.
Pardon? Madam Chair, I believe the minutes should have included me as excused from yesterday.
That's right. I remember that you were.
I was going to try to jump in line ahead of Representative Greiling to move their approval.
And then you left.
But then I thought I'd try this strategy.
Madam Chair, I would incorporate that as a friendly amendment.
That is definitely friendly. I did know that you were excused yesterday, and it just slipped my mind when I looked at the minutes. So we will. I would move then that the minutes be approved as corrected. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? All right. Minutes have been approved. And this meeting is adjourned, and you guys, next week, we will have session again on Wednesday at noon. Our committee gets